hello and welcome to another episode of Day to Day. I am joined by our ocean expert and guide, Dr. Hayley Evers-King. Hayley, it's good to see you.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Very well indeed. How are you going?
Good, thank you. Very excited for this episode.
And today we are talking about the upcoming launch of the Copernicus Sentinel 6 satellite, also known as Michael Frailish. Hayley, what is special about this satellite?
So this is another one of our Sentinel family, which is growing ever bigger all the time. So very exciting for us all to have this one soon to be launched in November this year, fingers crossed. The Sentinel 6 in particular is, well, from ASA primarily, and in terms of my background, an ocean mission. So it's actually an altimeter package on there that will be measuring things like the sea surface height. We'll talk more about this later. The satellite has altimetry on it, but it also has some other instruments, which are much more, I know, Mark, in your domain. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about those later too and learning a bit myself. It also includes radio occultation. So we'll hear more about that. But this mission is, as you say, something for the ocean, something for the atmosphere, something for the weather. But it's really, one thing that's really interesting for me about this mission is that it's a really strong international collaboration. We know it sits under the Copernicus program, which is this big European Earth observation program that's going at the moment. But for the Sentinel-6, we're actually collaborating further afield than just in Europe. We work with our partners in CNES in France on this, but we are also working with colleagues in the US. So NASA and NOAA are both collaborators on this mission. So it's a really big international effort towards our understanding of sea level.
So why is this you said another. Why is this following on from something? Is it part of a series? What's its heritage?
Well, it's one of the Sentinels. So it's adding into that sort of constellation of ocean measurements and earth measurements that we've got going at the moment. So it's linked quite naturally, as you might expect, to Sentinel 3, which is our other sort of ocean mission, primarily within Copernicus. But Sentinel 6 actually has a much, much bigger history than that as well. So you sometimes will have heard it in the last couple of years referred to as Sentinel 6 or Jason CS. You may have heard of the Jason satellites as well. And so Sentinel 6's heritage builds a lot upon this series of missions, the Jason satellites, which have been measuring the sea level and sea surface height and other parameters about physical oceanography for many, many years now. And what Sentinel 6 will be doing is adding to this record and sort of bringing together all these different measurements so we can continue into the future to look at trends in these parameters. So it builds upon the kind of state of the art, but with a really good view to making sure that the measurements we take now are synonymous with the measurements and align with the ones we had in the past so that we can actually look at long-term trends.
Later on, we'll be joined by Remco Shrew, who is UMATSAT's altimetry expert, and he's going to be able to talk a little bit about the history and how this fits into the heritage of sea surface height measurement. But Hayley, why is sea surface height so important to measure?
So many people, I'm sure, will have heard about the sort of sea level rise story when it comes to issues like climate change. So we know at the moment we have ice melting, we have oceans warming, and both of these things, amongst various other parameters, contribute to the actual sea level that we see and are contributing over the last sort of number of decades now to a measurable rise in sea level that we're attributing to anthropogenic climate change. So Sentinel 6 has a really important role to play in helping us to understand and measure exactly what is happening with regard to that. And we know that this sort of potential for sea level rise can have impacts on areas that are very important to us as society. Low-lying coastal areas, small islands, these are all under threat from a rise in the mean sea level, and as well the impact that that can then have on extreme events. Typically, we're looking at very small changes. I'm sure Remco will tell us more later about exactly how precise these satellites are able to measure. But we need to make these very precise measurements in order to extract these signals and understand and plan for what they might mean in our future. The other part of Sentinel 6, as you said before, is about weather. So, Mark, I'm going to actually turn this question back to you and say, what are you looking forward to from Sentinel 6 from your perspective as a weather guy?
The not sea level rise bit. So for weather, yeah. we find the measurements of the waves. So from the altimetry, you can also get information about the what we call the significant wave height. So you get a little bit of a sense of how big are some of the bigger waves that are underneath the satellite footprint at any particular point in time. And with a constellation of altimeters, we get really good information about waves all over the ocean. Obviously, this is really important for shipping. And we can see what we can do is some forecast centers, they will overlay an image of a storm with so the satellite image of a storm with the altimeter tracks over it with the winds. And you can actually overlay the ship positions on this, and you can see the ships moving away from the storms. So you can see how effective that is. And that kind of thing's really important. And then, of course, as you get into coastal environments, you're looking at how waves interact with coasts, which is really important for coastal forecasting. And also, as you mentioned earlier, there is a GPS receiver sitting on the top of the satellite. And what that's part of is a thing called radio occultation. And what the GPS receiver is doing is looking at the GPS satellites. And there will be times when one of the GPS satellites, the track from the satellite, the GPS satellite to the Sentinel-6 satellite, actually passes through the atmosphere. And the atmosphere itself will then bend that path slightly, and so delay the signal very slightly, and we can measure that delay. And from that, we can get a little bit of information about the density of the atmosphere, which relates to the temperature and humidity. And effectively, what we're doing is we're watching a kind of like a sunrise or sunset from the Sentinel-6 satellite. We're watching the setting and the rising of the GPS satellites, from which we can then get other meteorological information, which is kind of useful all around the world. So that gets fed into the computer models and is then part of the understanding of the whole global atmosphere. So it's another bonus that comes from this particular satellite.
Yeah, it's really quite a multi-purpose mission, this, actually. I mean, I think about it in the altimetry sense, but there's actually so much more that can sort of be derived from all the information that we're getting from this mission.
Yeah. And we also get a little bit of wind information as well. So as well, the altimeter signal travels down from the satellite. And when it hits the water surface, the more wind there is, the more signal gets scattered away from the satellite. And so we can get some sense of the wind speed under the satellite as well. But it's the sea surface height that I think that has the bigger societal interest in this particular one. Let's turn now and welcome our guest, Remco Shrew, who is EUMETSAT's altimeter expert. Hi there, Remco.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Hayley. Thanks for having me.
You are very welcome. Now, you've been working in altimetry for quite some time. What's your career been up to now?
Well, yes, I've been working with altimetry ever since I finished my master's thesis. That was in 89, that Carmen dates me. So for me, of course, this is very exciting because this is the first mission that I'm working on the side of a space agency like EUMETSAT. In the past, I've been user of the altimeter data, first at the university, Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, then later at NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And now we are getting ready to actually making it work. You know, as a user, you think, oh, this is all easy. You know, these agencies have lots of people and they will just crank out the system and it will come flowing into my mailbox and I'll have the data. But when you're actually at the space agency, you see how much work it is. It's not easy to get this done. And from now until the 10th of November, we will still be very busy preparing. While the satellite there is in Vandenberg and all the experts there are checking out the satellite itself, we are checking out our processes. And we are checking now that when we get the data, we simulate data at the moment coming in, and we're checking out that everything runs through so that there is a product that we can then deliver to our users. This will not be from the beginning. Of course, we first want to check out that everything runs okay once the satellite is flying. And that's called the commissioning phase. So we have planned a period of a year in which we are going to run the processes and check out that everything is according to plans.
So the short for, we've used the word altimeter a lot in altimetry. What is, in the short description, an altimeter? How does it work?
Well, I once described it as a tide gauge in space, but then using radar technology. So as you already said before, it sends a pulse of a radar pulse very regularly out of the satellite down to the Earth. and gets the signal back again, and basically times the time that it takes for this pulse to travel to the ocean and back. And that is a measure for how high the satellite is above the ocean. And you think, oh, what's that meaning to me? How high is the satellite above the ocean? Doesn't tell me anything. Yes, but at the same time, we also determine where the satellite is at the mm-hmm. at that time. For that, we have GPS on board, or more seriously saying GNSS, because it also has the Galileo receivers. Mm-hmm. And we have another tracking system called DORIS, and then yet another one as a fallback laser ranging. And all these together gave us a very, very accurate determination of where the satellite is at any given time. So accurate even that it's about 1 centimeter. So you can basically make a frame that is just slightly bigger than the satellite, and at any time you can tell the satellite went through this frame. And it will not hit it, you know. So that's incredibly interesting. So then we have the measurement. So then we can do the difference, and we get the height of the sea level. So the height of the satellite minus what the satellite measured this distance to the sea level gives the height of the sea level.
And how accurate is that?
Yeah, it's very accurate. In fact, every second we can measure the height of the sea level to about 2 to 3 centimeters. And that you can compare, if you want to imagine how accurate that is, you know, think about it. The satellite is 1,350 kilometers high. And then you measure the level of the sea to about 2 to 3 centimeters. That's the equivalent of measuring the length of the Golden Gate Bridge to the thickness of a hair, a human hair. It's that accurate. That is what we are doing. That's what we are doing. 24/7, the satellite is doing it all over the globe, all over the oceans. And after about 10 days, it has covered all of the global oceans. And then we can compute an average of that. And then 10 days later, we can do that again and again and again. And so onwards, we build up a time series of sea level over time. And that's the way we can tell if the sea level is changing.
And how accurate, so you mentioned the accuracy of the actual height of the ocean measurement. How accurate is the estimate of change in sea level, if that's meaningful?
What we want to reach is an accuracy of 1 millimeter per year. And in fact, we already think that we can probably even do better than that. We know that from the previous missions, we have already reached that kind of level. This is the first one that actually has the requirement. So to start with, we have made it to be designed to be that accurate. Mm-hmm. This to put it in perspective, sea level rise at the moment is, on average for the last 30 years, roughly, is 3 millimeters every year. So we have already seen that over the last 30 years, we have already seen the sea level rise by about 10 centimeters. But we also see that it's slightly accelerating, meaning that the rate is increasing. And in order to distinguish this increase particularly, we want to be very accurate. And we need to have this accuracy of a millimeter per year or better.
Now, you've been working in this for 30 years now. Where does Sentinel-6 fit into that history? How many altimeters have there been? What's the sort of projection? And do we need all these altimeters? What's the benefit of having a nice long series?
Well, there are two factors to this. One was already introduced by Harry, is that this is a next one in a long series. The series starts in 1992 with Topex Poseidon, and then was followed up by other missions, Jason 1, Jason 2, Jason 3. The reason, of course, why we need to launch new ones is because these satellites are getting old and they are starting to fail. So of the previous ones, Topex Poseidon, Jason 1 and Jason 2 have already failed. Jason 3 is still flying. And so we are building up from 1992 onwards a long-term record in which we can accurately see this change of sea level. Mm-hmm. One big part of it is that, of course, is that means that we need to tie one mission to the next. So because we are launching a new satellite, things might be slightly different. You know, it's a slightly different instrument, or the altimeter itself is located in a slightly different location. And of course, lots of this we try to measure on ground, but we can only really validate it very well on board when it's flying. And therefore, we always have this period of intercalibration, as we call it. Mm-hmm. So then the two satellites are flying very close together in time. In fact, JSON 3, which is now the reference mission for this for the long-term altimeter period, will then be flying together just 30 seconds behind Sentinel 6. Mm-hmm. That means that almost at the same time, we should measure the same thing.
Yep.
And that will allow us to do this very accurately, to cross-calibrate, so to make sure that Sentinel 6 is showing us what we already seen in JSON 3, but we will see it better for several reasons. Sentinel 6 is different from JSON 3. It's a different type of satellite. Haley was already referring to CryoSat. There is a bit heritage from that. For those who know CryoSat, it looks sort of like a doghouse, and Sentinel 6, similarly.
I was going to ask this, Remco, why does it look like a doghouse or a garden shed, do you know?
Yeah, actually, I do know this. But let's come back to that later if you want.
Sure.
Okay.
So it's a different kind of satellite, but it's also a totally different instrument. This instrument has a digital hardware. There is a reason for this. As I was explaining, we want to have a very stable measurement. If we want to be able to measure at 1 millimeter per year, a change of sea level at 1 millimeter per year, we should avoid that the satellite, for some reason or another, has some inherent drift, some aging effect. Mm-hmm. Digital hardware prevents part of this aging problem that we had in a lot of previous satellites. Of course, we have a whole set of calibrations again, measurements to try to measure this aging effect, but this one will certainly prevent some of it. A second part is, we have not discussed this instrument yet, but there is also an instrument on board called a microwave radiometer. The microwave radiometer gives us a measure for how much the signal is delayed in the atmosphere due to humidity. This is an important part of a correction that we need to apply to our measurements. And also, our experience is that these instruments have aging effects and other effects, even when switching it off and on. In order to, again, eliminate any of the introductions of jumps or drifts from the instrument itself, it has an external calibrator, meaning that the satellite can calibrate itself by looking at the cold space as a reference target. And this helps us to make that also more stable. So we have a more stable altimeter, a more stable radiometer, and that together gives us confidence that we can measure this sea level change to such a high accuracy.
Mm. Which you'll also check anyway using other sources of data, like you mentioned the intercalibration, and I guess checking with actual tide gauges and ground-based data.
Yes, and that's one of the parts that will be studied thoroughly throughout this first year of commissioning. There is a team set up of scientists called the Sentinel-6 Validation Team, and they will help us, meaning all the partners in this Copernicus Sentinel-6 mission, to evaluate the data so they can deploy their techniques, their in situ, their tide gauges or other measurement techniques to check what we are measuring. And that is very valuable and is a good source of information. And so these scientists can help us very early on in the mission. So they will be the first one to receive the data, check it out. And then when together we agree that this data is of good quality now, it will go to the general audience.
And all, I guess all of those reports, so the when you say it'll go to the general, that's also with the reports on all of those studies and everything you've done to validate the data. I think it's one thing I quite like about working in our world is the openness of the information about the instrument and its validation.
Yes, of course. We need to be very open about what we're doing. And that's, in fact, it's a heritage of the science community. And the science doesn't work without openness. And we need to, of course, tell everybody, you know, this is what we already found. And this is something that we want to improve. This is something where you can help us improve. And in fact, that's also one big part of it, is that the science community helps us to improve. Because you can imagine that the science that we do now is not anymore the science that we did in the 1990s when these altimeters first came really into fruition. And therefore, there is a continuous upgrading of the knowledge and that we implement in our algorithms and additional data that we use to process the satellite data. Mm. This is also built in to our planning. So every year or two, we will take all of the data again from the launch and reprocess it again with the latest information, with the latest algorithms that the scientists give us to us and say, here you can do better. This is what we know now. This is a better algorithm, more accurate algorithm, more precise algorithm. And we take that in, we reprocess all the data, and this will be done regularly. Mm-hmm. We already do that for satellites like Sentinel-3. That is a major undertaking, but it's so important if you want to study climate that you are always using the latest information and the latest inputs that we get from the science community.
So we've talked a little bit about the climate applications. Another area that we sometimes hear people asking about is applications of altimeters near coasts and on rivers. Are these data actually usable in these environments? What's changing? What's the prospect for the future?
Well, this is also one thing where Sentinel-6 excels over the previous reference missions, that it's more tailored towards coastal areas and also inland waters. It has what is called a high-resolution altimeter. Sentinel-3 already had this. CryoSat also had this. CryoSat had not much data storage on board to do it globally. Mm-hmm. But Sentinel-3 does, and so also Sentinel-6 will do that almost globally as well, at least over the oceans. And that allows us to measure very, very close to the coast. Here are various applications. Of course, when we're talking about sea level change, of course, we want to measure that also close to the coast and not only very far away from the coast. But also if we look at other applications like ocean currents, there are currents very close to the coast that are very narrow and need to be monitored as well and can be monitored with altimetry, and Sentinel-6 can certainly do that. With high resolution altimetry, we can also pick up rivers and we can pick up lakes. Now, of course, you can say, well, we can just drive there and do measurements in situ, but there are lots of rivers that are very remote and will have impact downstream. Think about the rivers that originate in the Himalayas and then can flood Bangladesh. So if we see with altimetry, we can monitor the levels in the rivers, in fact, with altimetry as well. So this is something that Sentinel-6 is going to contribute to, just as Sentinel-3 is already doing that as well.
So when you say high resolution, can you give us a feel for how big is high?
So the thing with altimetry is that the footprint is quite large. Footprint for a conventional or low resolution altimeter is of the order, depends a little bit on significant wave height, of the order of 3 to 5 kilometers or so. This is the smallest kind of footprint that you can get. Whereas with a high resolution altimetry, you can get footprints that are as short as 300 meters. So then you can pick up much more smaller patches of water and not be affected by the land that's around. So you can in fact, a river that is of that size, you can already pick up. And in fact, you can, with some experience that people are already doing, you can even get thinner than that. You can even pick up smaller water bodies.
Oh, wow. That's quite cool. So let's talk about spacecraft design. So Haley mentioned earlier the shape of the satellite. So we have a model just outside of UMETSAT, and it does indeed look like a small garden shed or a doghouse. Why is that, and how does that help?
Well, if you go back to a satellite like Cryosat, which looks very similar, and it's this doghouse, it had solar panels just on the roof of the doghouse, and they don't move. If you look at other satellites like Sentinel-3, like Envisat, and like the EPS satellites, METOP satellites, they all have these big solar panels and they rotate. And of course, rotation is something that can get damaged. You know, it needs to rotate the solar panel every revolution around. So this can go broke. Secondly, it also puts a moving thing on the satellite, a moving element on the satellite, which is meant to be very accurate in determining the sea level, right? If you're going to move the solar panel, you might move the center of gravity of the satellite. Mm-hmm. And so having no movable panels is better. Cryosat didn't have that. And Sentinel-6 doesn't have it either. It actually has two little solar panels that flip out after launch, but then they are stable. And so it makes it a more stable platform to work from because you have no movable solar panels. And this doghouse shape is kind of optimal because depending on where the sun comes from, you either have the sun on the one side of the doghouse or the other side of the doghouse. It's kind of an optimization. Of getting enough solar power onto your satellite to have the instruments running.
So whereas for other instruments for meteorology, tiny little movements like this don't cause an impact on what you're measuring. For you, where you're measuring position and therefore height, that's really important. So hence the doghouse.
Yes, and in fact, we have the problem had the problem for a long time with one of the earlier reference missions called Topex Poseidon, which had a solar panel that was kind of flexible, and we are still trying to resolve the impact of this flexible solar panel on the actual data retrievals.
So this is data from almost 30 years ago now that you're still working on and still finding ways to improve.
Yes, it's actually NASA, one of our partners also in Sentinel-6, who is again reprocessing this data, now almost 30 years old. In order to improve its standards and therefore improve this 30 years record, yes.
Yeah, because you mentioned it earlier with the whole reprocessing approach. A satellite mission now doesn't end when the spacecraft is decommissioned. That data and what you can do with the data and innovation is still possible afterwards. I find quite incredible in many ways to be able to go back and improve the data.
Yes, it's valuable to keep this data alive. I actually experienced this while I was working at NOAA. One of my colleagues was working on the data of yet an older satellite, an older altimeter that was launched in 1985 called GeoSat. And he was interested in reprocessing the data again, but it was very hard to find the tapes back again. Because people did not consider so much the storage, importance of the storage of the data. And he had a special company to retrieve the data from the tapes that were almost falling apart, that the magnetic information was almost falling off of it. And now, of course, with the huge storage capacities that we have, things get recycled, get moved around more easily than it was in those days when things ended up on just tapes.
Yeah. Now, one last question. So the Sentinel-6, Copernicus Sentinel-6, is also called Michael Freilich. Can you tell us a little bit about who he was and why the satellite also has his name?
Michael Freilich was a scientist an oceanographer who was very involved in satellite altimetry in the United States. He was a very respected scientist. He was involved in a lot of these missions. And shortly before the launch of the satellite, now roughly a year ago, it was decided to give the name of Michael Freilich to this first of the Sentinel-6 missions, Sentinel-6 satellites. We will have two, Sentinel-6A, which is then called Michael Freilich, in Sentinel 6B, the next one. Unfortunately, Michael Freilich died since then, and I think it's a very good to show the legacy of somebody who was that important in promoting the altimetry to have his name attached to this mission. I think it's a good contribution. He gave a good contribution and it's a good attribution to add his name to this satellite.
So if people want to see the Flying Doghouse, Hayley, I think you've made a video describing it.
Yes, we have. Yes, it's on our YouTube channel. You can check it out. Spend some time in the summer having a look at the new model when it arrived and pointing out all the different instruments. And you can see exactly that's so important shape, as we've learned today, why that is so important. You can see that in the model itself, as the solar panels are on a full-scale model outside of RHQ. So yeah, please check out our YouTube channel and have a look at that video if you want to know more about the actual nuts and bolts of the satellite itself.
And so I guess maybe a question for you, Hayley. So the data, as Remco's described, it's going to go out to users. How does it actually get out to the users? Who's going to be using it?
Yeah, so our users are a broad range of people, as Remco's mentioned. Lots and lots of scientists are using this data to look at questions around issues like climate change. They're looking at how we can actually improve our measurement methodology and all of that. But fundamentally, you know, this information goes out to people who are working in the maritime domain. So it goes out to meteorological and oceanographic institutions that provide information to, say, fishing vessels or different shipping fleets who really require this information for when it comes to safety. It goes out to organizations that will use it towards disaster management and things like that. And practically in terms of how it gets out, I mean, we have a range of different data services that we operate through UMetSat. Some of them users of our data will already be familiar with. And that's where my role sits. I work in the user services division at UMetSat, and we'll be helping people to get this data, starting with our experts who work through the S6VT. We'll be helping them access data via an FTP site, and then this will extend through time as we get further through the commissioning phase. More and more products will start going out to the general public, and all that information will be pushed out through our website, through our user notification service, through our product notices that we give to tell users what is ready, when, and what quality and any outstanding issues they can expect. So check our website for plenty more information on that.
And we've talked a lot about sea level rise and sort of the climate perspective just now, but I guess there's a whole bunch of other uses of the altimeter data. I'm just aware of a few. So for example, when people are looking at tropical cyclone forecasting, the heat from the ocean is what helps to drive the tropical cyclone or the hurricane. And by using the altimeter data, we can see how much bulk heat is available to get into the cyclone to fuel it. Remco, Hayley, are you aware of other sort of exciting or interesting altimeter applications? I'm sure you can name many.
Yeah, there's lots, actually. I mean, from a physical oceanography perspective, I mean, you can use this to look at any feature that potentially affects the height of the ocean. So we had a previous episode with Ada, who studies eddies, these ocean swirls. And this is one thing, you know, you can look at with altimetry data. You can look at the sort of circulation patterns and our currents, actually, when you combine multiple altimetry measurements together. And so that opens up a huge range of applications in the marine domain, all sorts of things around transport and these sort of intricacies of how our ocean moves. And that has effects on, you know, the biology, but also on the climate. So Remco, you have some other ones you want to talk about?
Yeah, there's one that is done talking about something actually that is static. You're talking about things that are dynamic. Mark talked about wave heights and wind speeds. You talk about eddies. Those are dynamic features that, of course, we need to regularly keep track of. But there's one that's very interesting is that the ocean surface models itself after the ocean bottom. This is very strange to realize, but if you have a mountain on the sea bottom, the sea surface actually is slightly higher. This is because of the change of gravity around the seamount. And that means that you can actually invert the height of the sea level and the variations of the height and sea level to the sea bottom topography. So you can actually make maps of the sea bottom just looking at the sea surface. This is amazing that it's possible, but it is true. And this has been done also with previous missions. And we were talking about JSON-1 and JSON-2 in the past. These have contributed to that as well. Even though they were not meant to do that, they were meant to do the oceanography, like Haley was also talking about, a following a pattern that maps the globe in 10 days. But by shifting the orbit slightly, we could make a very, very dense pattern, which was only repeated after about 1 year. And that allows us to, at high detail, get this static pattern. And because it's static, we have done this similar thing with previous missions as well. Why is this now important? Well, first is because mapping of the sea bottom can be very relevant. First of all, the sea bottom, of course, changes the dynamics of the oceans. When you have a ridge of seamounts on the bottom, your ocean dynamics change as a result. So it helps the modeling of ocean currents. But also, for example, tsunamis. They are very much changed by the bottom topography. So if we know better what the bottom topography is, people can also forecast the impact of earthquakes that happen somewhere on the ocean and how the tsunamis will land and where they are higher or lower. So this is something that is amazing, that you can map the sea bottom from the sea surface. It's kind of exciting.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for your time. So Remco, where will you be for the actual launch?
Well, that depends a little bit on the situations of the pandemic again. There seemed to be a planning for a event at ESOC here in Darmstadt. I might need to go there. But if restrictions are too high, we might need to follow them all remotely. So let's see.
All right. So we wish you well for all of the work you do now, between now and the launch, and of course, after the launch and through the commissioning. And hopefully we'll get a chance to speak to you maybe in a year's time to find out what we're already able to learn from the Sentinel-6 Microfilish mission. Excellent. Haley, when will data be available to the users?
So the first data that will be available to the general public should come out around about 6 months after launch. Of course, it's the commissioning phase, so you know we have to make sure everything is okay, and this is dependent on the data being of good quality. But the first product should start coming out around about 6 months after.
Awesome. Thank you both so much. And if you would like to follow the launch, there'll be information available on the UMATSAT website for the live launch link. So you will actually be able to see the launch take place. And of course, there'll be more information on the UMATSAT website to give you access to the data. I wish you all well in these times. Please, of course, stay safe. And I hope you enjoy your day today.